Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is Labor Day weekend, and this is Yvonne Smith in Late Night with a Hero. And tonight I have on Gail Bluebird. Many people do know Gail, but some of our listening audience may not. Gail has been, at least I met Gail at, I believe it was Alternative. She's a known fixture. There are only two people that I can kind of remember being there all the time, and one of them is Gail, and the other one is Sally Zinman and Mr. Joe Rogers, who has appeared on this show twice. Now, Gail Bluebird, RN, has been active in the consumer survivor movement since 1974, and she's worked in many different capacities. Prior to retiring, she worked in the state of Delaware as director of peer services for 5 years. She worked on a team at the National Association of State Mental Health Program Directors from 2002 to 2014. And for many people that know Gail, she also was instrumental in putting together and writing a document around peers working in state hospitals. In 2010, she was recognized with a National SAMHSA Voice Award at Paramount Studios in Los Angeles for contributions as a consumer advocate and activist. She's a very, I would say this, that was very colorful. She would characterize herself as being a flamboyant dresser, and she created a character called Miss Henrietta, which I hope that she will join the show as well. Her current goal is to organize the first national Made Arts Festival for Mental Health Consumers in 2016 and to keep writing her own memoirs. She has published a poetic memoir. Her poetic memoir can be found on Amazon, You're Pretty When You Smile. And I would suggest people that are listening by blog radio that they go and get pencil and paper, because I'm quite sure that Gail will have some very important information to partake to us. Gail, thank you for being on the show.
Well, thank you, Yvonne, and you're right. We do go back many years, and I don't remember exactly what year, but I know it was definitely Alternatives, and we had many encounters and times where we spent time together. And so I thank you for having me on the show. I also thank the audience. Anybody who's on, I think, is doing well, particularly because it's a holiday weekend. And I hope that something fun is planned for tomorrow for everybody. Mm-hmm. But
people that know Gail, the pre workshops to Gail are always about the arts, and Gail has put that in there. But before we get into the arts, I just wanted to know, how long have you been involved with Alternatives in the Movement? Because it seems to me, it's like I can't remember a time when you weren't.
Well, it was interesting because, Yvonne, the other day when we talked, you thought that my history was really focused on the fact that I was a nurse early on and that I had contributed a great deal. Pardon?
Go ahead.
But I really have a personal history that a lot of people probably don't know about, and if that's okay, I'd like to share some of that.
Yes, I do. I would like you to share that because I wasn't quite sure, and everybody that comes through this is not, and when we get into a lot of the things that you've done, I might, because you've done a great deal of work in the movement. How did you come to this? I mean, I didn't look at you whether you were a peer or not, that you were a supporter. And
yeah, I mean, I was more than a supporter. I was really a survivor. But I think I was just really surprised that you didn't know that. A lot of people probably don't. So let me share some of that with you.
Okay.
Well, first of all, I think we all have had childhoods that have been troubled or that some of our problems started there. So without going into any of those details, I definitely was a depressed person, a withdrawn person. I thought of myself as very sad. And as I grew older, that became even more prominent. By the time I had three children, I was withdrawing even more. And I'm going to use the term regressing, which is something we don't really use that term in the movement. But it was something that I was doing and was aware of, that I was acting more like my children than I was an adult. So I was involved in something called prime therapy. Some people might remember that. There was books written about it. And there
what
was
kind
a woman
was
who
it?
Wrote... Pardon?
What kind of therapy did you say it was?
Well, it was called primal therapy. There was a author named Arthur Janov at the time. This goes back, you know, maybe a little before you. I don't know, Yvonne, but at any rate, I went to a therapy in Atlanta whereby I spent 3 hours per day in kind of a regressive therapy. And so at some point I thought that I really needed to become this, you know, I needed to allow this repressed and regressed person to be that individual. And a woman wrote a book called All My Children. Again, I don't think most people would know about this book, but her name was Jackie Schiff. And she wrote about the fact that she took in, quote, schizophrenics, people who were schizophrenic, who had very serious histories, you know, jumping out of windows and I don't know what all, but people that somehow got there, either their parents had sent them there. By this time, she had a reputation for being able to, quote, reparent. That was the term, and there was a term that other therapists were using called reparenting. So I left my children one day, actually, and got on an airplane and went to California to become part of the, quote, Jackie Schiff family. Took me a little while to get in. She lived in outside of Berkeley, in Diablo, California, actually. And so at the time that I was there, there were 10 other people, adult children, who were acting as children. And some of them were regressed into baby, into the fact that they were being cared for as babies, breastfed, bottle fed. It was very probably the only place or the only person in the world who had, you know, done these kind of cutting edge or whatever type therapies. Well, to make a long story short, I stayed in the Schiff family. One of the things that happened while you were there is that you relinquished your name and you became you became a Schiff. You know, your name became Schiff, which was Jewish. You were not in touch with your family, and there were a lot of family rules so that at any given time you were being observed by the other participants in the family. By this time, you're a family member. You're a kid in the family. And much of the time we were being punished or being confronted for whatever kinds of games we were playing, and that was kind of games. And we had to stand in corners with a bowl of sestagen. I don't even know if sestagen still exists. I have to look that up, but it was like a bowl.
What, is it 1960s or 1970s?
This is in the 1970s. Thank you for asking me that. This was in 1973 that I think I left and went there. Well, again, to kind of summarize this, I stayed there for 6 months, and I started observing things that I knew were not right. This was not a woman that I thought really was a person that I cared about or who cared for me. And I began to think that she was exploiting people. Later I found out, or during that time, I found out that she was really under investigation, and I began hearing about a boy who had burned in a bathtub. And again, I told her that she was punitive, and whose burns, the way she described it to audiences, she was a speaker that went all over the country, that this person, this boy had burned, suffered a first-degree burn that changed into a third-degree burn because he was schizophrenic. Well, as you know, I was also a nurse, and I'm like very suspicious and not, I didn't really believe that. Then I began to hear from the other family members that that really wasn't what happened. At any rate, I was among people that were a whole lot less resourceful than I was. I had a car, was unusual in that sense. And Jackie, my, quote, mother, had decided that I should continue to work as a psych nurse. Now, this is odd, very odd and unusual, and, you know, even to my own self, I think it's an unusual kind of circumstance, that I was sometimes left out of corners. She didn't want me to, quote, incapacitate. I remember her using that word. So I was to continue working. And again, I was the only person in the family who had this ability to do that. And eventually what I found out...
Huh? Did you have to turn your money over to them?
Oh, yes, I did. I paid for, you know, whatever it was I paid for. I think I probably gave most of my money over to, you know, Jackie Schiff. That's true. Thank you. It's a memory I don't even remember. But eventually what happened is that I found and discovered that I felt safer at work being a psychiatric nurse than I did living in the family. And I also, so I had two things going on. One, this abuse of what I began to call abuse living in this family, and then the abuses of the psychiatric system. And I'm not sure even to this day which I would say was worse. And I finally left there one day.
Let me backstroke for a little bit. Let me back up a little bit. Now, was this woman, was she a psychologist?
She was a social worker.
Mm-hmm.
She was a registered social worker. And she had started work with her husband, who had been a psychologist, who then they divorced, mm-hmm. and she continued this the so-called reparenting work. And she had a reputation. You know, she was going all over the country and taking her favorite regressed kids with her. It just sounds all very strange. I don't know how to describe it, but
We've had several people on the show who have had these kind of experiences. And
you have?
I haven't
okay.
had that, but some yes, we've had people on like that. Nancy
okay.
Jackson was on the show, too. We had several people. This is not an unusual thing, especially in the 1970s. It was not.
Right.
This will ring true for a lot of people. But so she was a social worker, and she parented adults.
Yes, called reparenting. And eventually she was banned out of the country. I didn't really see what exactly happened, but I know that she was banished is the only way I can put it, and could no longer practice here. So she went to, just to say a little bit about that, I know that she went to England, I know she went to India, and in England I was contacted by somebody because there were all kinds of newspaper expose articles for what she was doing, because she was diapering people, which I was familiar with, and it's just, I was just caught up in that, and it was kind of cultish, and even when I left, there was a certain part of me that felt like I had failed, you know, that I had failed my children, my own children, had failed myself, because this was supposedly the miracle worker that I was going to, and so I was now in even further, you know, stigmatizing myself as a failure, I guess, is the way I can, and so I became even more sad, withdrawn, depressed, and all of those things, and diagnosable, which I had already been diagnosed. So So then I think what you were also interested in is, well, then how did I get involved in the movement?
How did you get out from under Jackie Schiff? How did you get out of Jackie Schiff?
Took my car and left on a particular day, deciding that I could no longer be there. It was a brave kind of thing to do, because when you were there, you really felt, it was almost like you were in prison. You didn't just leave, but I had a car, and remember, I had a job, so, but I had nowhere to go, and I remember staying in a homeless shelter until I could find a place on my own to live. So I remember, and I think I lived out of my car for, you know, kind of typical sort of stories that all of us share. So, and, you know, without knowing where next to go, you know, here I am, the next stage of being, you know, alienated from everything.
Well, you know, I'm glad that you're saying something about that. We've had many people that had that experience. I can't remember his last name, but one of the Beach Boys, Brian, I can't remember Brian's last name. But he was under the control of a therapist. And, you know, I've heard this many times when many people have been under control. I had family control, but there are many people that have been under control of people who have misused their role as a helper. That's the sort of way that I would describe
it. It was something also that Sally Zinman, I don't want to go off into her story, but I don't know if you've ever had her on, but she also was somebody that shared the kind of experience of being under the control in an abusive environment, and I'll just put it that way, and it was even more probably abusive than what I experienced, although it's kind of hard to say. So,
What I'm saying is that this is important because this is the history of persons like yourself, myself, and Sally, where we come out of these abusive relationships with either a therapist or the mental health system. So
exactly.
It is important because it is different than, I'm not saying that my pain is no different than is greater than yours or yours is greater than somebody else's. But when we talk about people that are survivors, and then, you know, we have people now that may have had a casual relationship with the mental health system that may not have been, they were voluntarily also, but maybe they haven't had some of the draconian things that have happened to us that have happened. And these are
right.
People who are survivors who have really been hurt by what's happened and know the potential that when you submit and give yourself all to, could be, like I said, it's not a system because there are really people behind all of these goings on. And I hate to say this, but not to the point of dappering, but this still goes on. The way you describe where people take control of a person's life.
Oh, absolutely.
Even people that are well-educated, people that have well-educated, have multiple degrees. People can't understand this. Well, why did you stay? Why did you go back to that therapist? Why do you keep going? And there is a kind of systematic way in which people are, their personhood is taken away from them. And that's what I meant was, how did you come to this? So you got in the car and you didn't come back.
Right. Well, my next stage, of which there's several different, you know, the homelessness and finding some way to wherever I was going to belong. Belonging is a big word for me because that was something I never felt. And so here I am wandering again, not belonging and feeling, you know, like a lost orphan. I always describe myself as an orphan. an event. I'll just add a little humor to that. I eventually started a sandwich business called Orphan Annie Sandwiches. I like to think back. That was back in those days, too, and during the years I was gone. But at any rate, the way I got to the movement, which I think is interesting, is I think the way it happened was that I became roommates with somebody who was involved, very much involved in the anti-psychiatry and the beginning of our movement. And her name, I never thought about this either, but her name was Jackie Damon. And she was very much a part of the Network Against Psychiatric Assault, and which was just beginning at the time that I was leaving the Schiff family and finding my way. And what I remember is going to see, I think there was an ad in the paper that Leonard Frank and Wade Hudson had put in the paper about beginning survivors, you know, I don't know what the words were at the time, but I don't think it was the word survivor, but people that had been, you know, incarcerated was more like the word. I don't think they used that in an ad, but they had
but people don't know.
Do you personally know who Leonard Frank was?
No.
He was really the founder of our movement. He recently died. He started the Network Against Psychiatric Assault back in the 70s, actually Wade Hudson and Leonard. And between both of them, they were the ones who, first of all, they had an art gallery, and then they set up an office in San Francisco, which became the office for the Network Against Psychiatric Assault. Leonard wrote a book on shock treatment, which is, you know, Sally and some of us, I don't know that I have it right now, but the history of shock treatment.
I do know who you're talking about. He has a long beard, right? Didn't he have a long beard? Yeah. I know who you're talking about now.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
He died very recently.
Yeah, in the last couple of months, yes, he did. Mm-hmm. And I'll say one thing that stood out about him is that our movement, and this is really to jump, and I'm not going there right now, but as the movement progressed and people started involving themselves with the federal government or taking money, there were a few people, Leonard being one of them, that refused to do that. He was not going to become part of an integrated movement, if I want to call it that, he was not going to sacrifice his values of rejecting the entire value system or the entire psychiatric system to in any way ameliorate or to become part of or become part of a system. There's a few other words I could use, but so anyway, so I started to become involved, and it was also at the time that Madness Network News, which was starting to, be printed and carrying the news across the country and finding out that there were other places in the country that were also forming groups. The Madness Network News was able to bring all of that together. Now, here's another interesting thing. I mentioned the word about belonging. In the early days, in those days, there was a very strict criteria for belonging to this movement, and it was that a person had to been hospitalized. Now, oddly enough, it could have been that somebody had only been hospitalized a few days or, you know, years, or they might have been institutionalized. But the word hospitalization was the key word, and I didn't fit that key word. I didn't fit a person who had experienced, even though I had, you know, suffered under with psychiatric abuse in a different way, I didn't fit their strict criteria. So I remember one of the experiences I had. There were a lot of different meetings that took place and little mini conferences And I remember very clearly Judy Chamberlain throwing me out of a meeting because she didn't think I belonged there. So that was just another time, you know, that I was not a belonger. But there were ways I decided that there was a reason why I, you know, that I needed to be part of this movement. And so I really did become a member in a variety of different ways. Several experiences stand out for me. And one was that I was working at Herrick Hospital. That was another reason I was probably considered suspicious. But I wound up giving Leonard, I think, and some of the others that were now by this time demonstrating at hospitals that were doing electroshock treatment. And Herrick was known for that. There was a known shock doctor. They were busily putting out the names of the shock doctors around the country, and Herrick stood out as one of the main key places. So I gave them the name of an individual who had not given consent, who was of age to give consent, and caused a demonstration. And I will remember always walking up. There were very, very long steps up to the lobby of Herrick Hospital, and I was going to work, and here were all these demonstrators with signs, and here I was, the person who had caused this particular demonstration. And of course, went into the nurses' meeting where I'm hearing all of this, you know, buzz of what they thought, and you know, there was a part of me that sort of gloated or glowed inside for being able
you were
to expose
a
this.
That.
Yeah,
I was
an insider.
A mole inside.
Huh? What? I was.
You
what?
Were a mole inside. You were
I was
a mole
inside. Yes, I was. Yes, I was. Then there were two other demonstrations that are known.
Now, what year was that? What year was that about? In the
1975. I believe. I think it was 1975. Mm-hmm. And during that same year, there was a sleep-in at Governor Jerry Brown's office. And that Sally talks about in her history of our movement. It's well known. We had gotten permission. I sort of say we, but they, because I wasn't really one of the leaders at that time. I was one of the people who always felt like I was... There was a reason why I was there. I wasn't one of the spokespersons. I wasn't one of the people who got up and, you know, stood in front of a podium or, you know, matter of fact, my sweater was buttoned up and I was like very, very frightened little person, I guess you could say, orphan. But
you
I was there.
Your internship.
I was in my internship. Thank you. That's exactly right. I was learning. I was in college. I was getting my PhD, but or my master's or whatever. But so anyway, that particular demonstration was about the atrocities that were happening in state hospitals. People were dying at the time, and nobody was investigating the deaths. People were being used as forced labor or unpaid labor. Then there was the issue of seclusion and restraint, and many other issues as well, all of which the spokespersons, I know Leonard was one of them, and there were other leaders who are not known so much today, brought to the attention every day in meetings. And, you know, we had our sleeping bags, and we slept in that rotunda of the governor's office, and that was quite quite historic, I think. And one other thing that I did, I'm also watching my time a little bit because I want to talk about another way that I think I contributed to this movement. But one thing that happened that nobody knows about, really, or remembers, is that we had a demonstration at St. Mary's Cathedral. And I don't know the exact date, but this, again, was in 1975, and Leonard had organized it. And it was sort of a... abstract reason on it turned out that St. Mary's Cathedral gave money to St. Mary's Hospital that contributed to a practice of sheeting individuals, which is a form of restraining. And so I was chosen to be the person carried down in a stretcher with a wig on, and I was supposed to be Jesus Christ. So I had one experience in my lifetime of being, you know, the Jesus Christ. But at any rate, we marched down the aisle. There were people dressed up in Yannicka. Yannickus was one of them, and I can't remember the names of all of the others, but somebody was dressed as a nurse, somebody was dressed as a psychiatrist and whatever, and we walked down during the benediction where nobody knew why we were even doing this, and then we walked quietly out. To me, it was the most dignified demonstration I know about. And then we passed out leaflets that said, if Jesus were here today, would he be considered mad? Somewhere in my belongings, I have that letter that Leonard had written. So that was, I think, very strategic and very memorable. So then the next thing I wanted to say, do you want to say anything?
And by the way, people are listening. I'm getting messages. Someone is saying, I knew Leonard. I was in school in 1975. I began in the movement about 1979. So there are people that remember these events.
Okay,
so,
great.
Okay.
I'll look forward to the
remember.
Time when we hear from mm-hmm. people. Mm-hmm. Well, another part of my history that I think is real significant, and I just really have to thank you because I feel like this is an opportunity for me to say something about when I left Herrick Hospital with a resignation letter. And I have a date on this, May 28, 1975. During this time when I was working there, I also started organizing other nurses, and we started meeting. It was very, very historic, actually. And not to go into all of what we did, because we did some protesting and had people from the administration of the hospital meeting with us to go over some of what we thought were the abuses. And nurses don't do that anymore. I'm not, I guess if I was working a nurse, I would still be organizing them. But in my resignation letter, the points that I made in this letter, I was Gail Shooker at the time, were ones that I would eventually work on in my, in all of the things that I did afterwards and over the years really were laid out in this letter. And I'm just going to briefly read lines of it. This is what I wrote. I realized that because of the label, in quotes, mental illness, we proceed to, in quotes, treat persons as such with drugs, seclusion rooms, and other forms of what I consider a furtherance of people's alienation and fear of others. I can no longer take part in this process. To be more specific, I am concerned with many practices that I feel are destructive and perpetuating of the patterns of behavior the person presents. Some of these practices include, and I'm summarizing.
Mm-hmm.
One, extended, prolonged use and misuse of medications. Two, patients not receiving substantial and complete information in regards to side effects they may encounter. Three, the use of electroshock treatment, which I question the overall value of, and question the effects of brain damage, which I know is documented in many cases. Four, the length of time spent by personnel in charting and the fact that patients do not have access to these records upon request. Five, the injunction against visit. This was a big one for me and still to this day is a huge issue. The injunction against physical contact inhibiting patients receiving nurturing contact versus repressive contact, i.e. restraining a patient, breaking falls, which is encouraged and validated. In other words, we encourage these negative ways, restraining, but not encourage physical contact. Six, the using of seclusion rooms, which are, first of all, very lacking and dangerous, even in their physical design. I am aware that the seclusion rooms do not afford patients protection from bodily harm. They have bare walls, tile floors, a frosted window high up, a mattress, pillow, and a locked door, and are extremely cold in winter. Well, this goes on, and I don't want to read all of it, although I think that whole paragraph that I wrote.
This was in Enrico, California? This was in Enrico, California?
This is in California at Herrick Hospital, May 1975. The seclusion room issue was one that I took with me and felt that it was compelled that I had, as a nurse, it gave me something that I could use to then later develop comfort rooms. And Yvonne, you know that that was something that I did, and now today many hospitals have them, although when I try to sort of do a little research, I find that some of them
are... I try to get St. Elizabeth here to have you to come, and I just want to say this a little bit about it, because a lot of places have rooms, and they just changed the name. They were seclusion rooms, and they're still seclusion rooms, because for me, a seclusion room is the one that you're not locked in, and it's not just a room that you just change the name of. And I've worked in two hospitals, one where they actually had a real seclusion room, and a place where they had a room where they called it seclusion room. And last week, I know you're crying. Even last week when I went past one with a guest in the hospital, someone asked what that is. And one of the patients said, it's a comfort room. And the guest said, how can that be a comfort room? The only thing in there is a beanbag.
Right, right. Fortunately, there's some really nice comfort rooms have been developed, and I have pictures of them. And my last effort, I think I did a webinar a conference call for Howard Trackman. I think you're part of that group. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yeah.
The seclusion and restraint?
Yeah, seclusion and restraint. Yeah.
Right. And mm-hmm. I started trying to find out where comfort rooms, you know, what was happening with them, and discovered that there were some good stories, and would really like to follow up with even more. But I do know that the concept took on, and that many places have developed rooms, and then some of them have kind of gone to, you know, there's a whole variety of reasons why they don't become actual comfort rooms, and they become more like places of restriction, I guess you could say, or they're so highly monitored that they're not places where people can go and really feel comfortable, which was it's more like a timeout room, and you know, there's so much fear around them, and you know, so it's sort of, after a while, it sort of defeats the purpose. And you know, I learned a lot about what can be done to make them successful, and you know, and still have some safety concerns for them. But it's not my focus right now, but it's going to always be something that I think is important, and probably, you know, at some time to time pick up on that very issue. So I just want to read just a little bit more that I wrote, because it also led to some of the other things that I have worked on. So I wrote in this piece that I think the patient does not progress. Because there is an encouragement of distance from the person and a discouragement of closeness and trust-building relationships. I observe patients' continual and repeated returns to the hospital, and I think this is due to the fact that we have no viable alternatives for them, and that they have by this time bought the idea that they are, in fact, in quotes, ill, and the only place to get well is the hospital. However, repeatedly, I hear their voice frustrations in regard to being in the hospital with a lack of things to do, even down to simple things such as providing good reading materials on the ward. So that last line is interesting to me because I hadn't read this in a while, but I also made reading, you know, in libraries and what books and whether any of the libraries had books, you know, written by consumers, which we have many of them. And, you know, even to this day, they don't have them. They're not aware of them. And so, mm-hmm. you know, issues continue over the years, you know, that I've worked on them, and there's always some progress. So, you know, I feel good about the progress, but, you know, sort of disappointed about the lack of progress.
I want to tell people if they want to come online that the phone number is 267-521-0167. That's 267-521-0167. I know that you have a lot of things you want to say. People that are that are listening by way of internet or smartphone, they can't call in. You have to call in by using the telephone number. And I want to remind people that are listening by their computer that you can go to Google Play and download an app called Blog Radio, and all the episodes are kept online. Again, the phone number is 267-521-0167, and you need to press 1 or star 1 to let me know that you want to come in. Someone has asked, does she remember the big Boston Globe series on children in hospital dying called Deadly Restraints?
Yes, I do. I don't have a copy of it anymore, but I do remember it, yes. And that mm-hmm. was a big, big expose. I think it might have been done either during the time that we were developing, that I will mention Kevin Hookshorn's name, really to honor her and to credit her with the work that she led while she was at NASPID, National Association of State Mental Health Program Directors. And she developed a team of experts to developed a whole curriculum around how to reduce seclusion and restraint in hospital settings. And then I became part of that team, and we went, all over the country. I think Kevin is still doing some of that work every once in a while. I think the most recent thing that we did was in Massachusetts, where, oddly enough, you would have thought that in Massachusetts they would have, being leaders in a lot of different ways, would have stopped this practice, but that wasn't necessarily true. And so some places in the country have been able to almost eliminate, and I say almost, but other places really continue to use restraints and or seclusion, one or the other or both, even despite training that they've received. But there was a lot of work done on that for a number of years, several years when Kevin was at NASPID, and at that time I was there also.
You mean Kevin from Delaware, right?
The commissioner for Delaware? To bring you up to date, she just has moved to North Carolina. She left her latest work in Delaware, where she was the commissioner of mental health in Delaware for, I think, 6 years, and then she brought me up there to develop peer support programs, which was a very, great time of my life, although probably the most challenging time of my life. But she then left to do independent consulting, and I retired in January, being 72 and feeling like I'd done enough of my work working within a bureaucracy, not done with my work, but working to kind of, you know,
what was peer support? I don't want to interrupt you because I'm getting messages saying let you talk, but what was peer support like back in those early days, and how does it compare to what's happening now, and I want to get some, you know, retrospection from you about, you know, what's going on now.
Well, I'm not going to paint this. I'm not going to paint a beautiful picture of what happened in the early days. What was happening was the building of the building blocks of what would then later become the drop-in centers, peer-run drop-in centers. Judy Chamberlain wrote a book, On Our Own, which today is, you know, considered a historic, I wanted to say the Bible of our movement, and the beginning primer of how to establish a peer-run program. And a matter of fact, I don't even think it was limited to drop-in centers. I think she had other programs that were, you know, that she was working on or working with. But what was interesting about the early drop-in centers is that almost always they were led by people that were on Social Security. You know, they had no money. And so they were committed to the values of peer support, of people being equal, of people having equal power. And actually, there was the sort of the shunning of leadership. There might have been a leader of a drop-in center, but it wasn't considered the most important thing. Most important was the fact that people were supporting each other and learning from each other, and usually also participating in, you know, the politics of change and being aware of that. I think that in the 80s, and let me just now mention, and I'll mention it again at the end of the program, is that Sally and I are doing a webinar on the history of the movement on Friday. Sally goes much more into that early history, the philosophical piece of it, and I go in later into the arts piece of it, which I'm very familiar with. But and Sally was very instrumental in the development. That was her passion right from the beginning when she was involved in the movement, was developing the alternatives. And she has, you know, she's now in later 70s, and still at it, still working at developing alternative organizations and alternative drop-in centers.
Who's the sponsor of the webinar? Who is the sponsor of the webinar?
Optum. And let me just say that you can. I was going online to see, it's 12 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, done by Optum, www.optum.com. Peter Ashton at optum.com is the sponsor of it. But I don't have the call-in numbers, but I think you can find out about it at www.optum, because I think that would be a really good place to really answer some of the questions of how the values of the early movement, I will say this, I think they haven't really changed. And the work that Sally and Howie, the HARP, I hope all of you know that name that are listening, wrote a book. All of a sudden it escapes me. What was the name of the book that, this first workbook, Reaching Across? And, you know, to review the chapters, and particularly the one that Howie wrote, which was particularly on the subject of peer support, if you read that, it's, you know, the words might be different, but the values are exactly the same. Exactly. I mean, he could have written a primer on how to develop a peer specialist program, actually. But I think that the years changed, and again, what Sally will talk about on Friday is that during the 80s, the first people, what I know to be true is that the first agencies that began to take notice of us was the federal government. I don't know if they were called the Center for Mental Health, SAMHSA, the Center for Mental Health Services. I think they were called something different at the time. I just can't name it. But they began to notice that that all these programs were developing and what, you know, and were being successful. People were changing. People were going to these programs. People were learning how to support each other. And they did five, I think, demonstration projects that were funded, that were drop-in centers. Unfortunately, the funding didn't continue. But it was the beginning of a movement, and in a sense it was like a spinoff of the early movement towards something that was going to evolve into the, I think some people would call it the peer support movement of today.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is what the thing is, they're two distinct things, I think. People that were the ex-survivors and then the peer worker movement, I think that they are two different things. I mean, some people straddle both of them, but some people that don't really want to be a peer worker, and they think it's all about, you know, about human rights.
Well, I think there's two different things. There's an advocacy movement.
Saying.
Yeah, there's an advocacy movement, and there's people working on rights issues. And for several years, I worked for the Disability Rights Network in Florida. At that time, it was called the Advocacy Center for Persons with Disabilities. And my role there was not as a peer supporter, not doing services, but strictly as an advocate. And I was a strong advocate, you know. And
so
I went
Dana
into the
Farmer.
State hospital anyway. Huh? I'm sorry? Mm-hmm.
You know Dana Farmer?
Yes, I worked for
Dana.
She was my supervisor, Dana Farmer.
Okay.
And she's an amazing person. And I will say also, just to put in a little plug, she, I think I worked for the advocacy center for, I don't know, 3-4 years. But two of those years were to develop the peer network, the Florida Peer Network. Because, and again, it, you know, it was Dana, really, that saw the importance of a statewide network that would serve as advocates, you know, to organize peers in the state.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, I'm glad that you mentioned Dana Farmer, because I think, you know, I think a lot of people don't know her name, but she was definitely somebody that, you know, in the last number of years has been contributed a great deal. So to continue with the thread of what you were saying, there's people that are advocates, and then there's people who are providing services, and which are generally called peer specialists, although there are now many terms for who peer specialists are. Sometimes the word is inclusive. The word peer supporters is used to be inclusive of all of the different roles that peers are playing. And I hope that nobody on the call would downplay the role that peers are playing, because even if we were to criticize or analyze whether or not all of these programs are successful, they're evolving. They're evolving as we speak. And so I know that you and I talked a little bit, Yvonne, about my talking about some of the things that I think are important. Do you want to specify that a little bit?
Well, you started talking about, you're saying that people are doing this on different levels, and we've had several surveys and things where it depends on who you talk to. Some people say, well, you know, this is just people working a little bit above minimum wage. And then you have other people that say, oh, all the people that work for me, they make competitive wages. They're making $30,000, $40,000. It's not just them off of benefits. And people use the term peer specialist very loosely. There are people who actually, what they're doing is they're trainers. And they may not really be having one-on-one experiences with other people. Oh, Lord, I'm getting flashes in here. But it says, what good is it to work in a system that still harms people and are nothing more than collaborators of a broken system? So I'm getting some messages here. But, you know, the gamut of people who are working, who are, I guess, willingly self-disclosing is on a and maybe that you can clear up. Some people call themselves peer specialists, but they're really not. Peer specialists, I think, is the frontline workers. And there are other people where they are really doing training or they're managing other people. They're not that, and they're there. But what I wanted you to talk about was how, oh, you may not agree with me that somehow that some people have gotten away from the values of peer support and the threats that we have now going on.
Okay. I really thank you for saying the word self-disclosure, because I made kind of a list of things, and oddly enough, that's a huge issue, and I've written about this. I've spoken on panels, and I think the first thing that I think is a requirement, an essential, is that people self-disclose. And oddly enough, I mean, I found it astounding that for some places in the country that are training peer specialists, that isn't the most important thing, that people have an option. So I really have a problem with that. People,
well, not only some people say that they can't disclose. Some people say they can't disclose, even though that's what their job title is.
Let me just say that I don't know, I'm not aware of any place that you can't, let me just talk in general terms, because there's always going to be in certain places or incidents or experiences that people have that are not the average experience. I will say that most places, self-disclosure is one of the criteria for being being a peer specialist. Then you get into, well, what does that mean? What does it mean to self-disclose, and who is that person? And I have a problem with that sometimes, because originally what this meant is that somebody that has been, quote, diagnosed with a, quote, serious mental illness. You can't anymore say, well, it's because somebody had been hospitalized, but it should be somebody that whose life experiences have been very marginalized, very much changed because of their, and now I'll use the word trauma experiences, their life experiences, or their having been labeled or diagnosed as a person with mental illness. But they must have had experiences that somehow lend themselves that can be used to share with other people. They should not be people that have just had, you know, counseling or, you know, what's the point? You know, you might as well be another psych worker, because the whole idea of peer support is, and this goes back to the way Howie the Harp described it and the way, or defined it, and the way that we defined it many, many years ago, which at that point, I will say, wasn't really in question. It was just obvious that when you joined this movement, you weren't, one thing is you weren't in it for the money, because there was no money to be had. You know, you were in it because you really, you know, you really believed that there was something that you could share with other people that would be
help them,
consciousness raising, you know, that would be, well, you can
supportive.
Add the words, go ahead, supportive, you know, that would change their lives. I like to think that one of the things peer specialists should be doing is changing people's lives. But in order to do that, you have to, just like if you were a cancer survivor and you were to counsel somebody else because you wanted to share your experiences as a cancer survivor, you wouldn't do that because, you know, you had once had a mammogram. I mean, I don't know. I think you get the point. But I think that this whole issue is getting kind of, quote, watered down or diluted a little bit. And that's also not to say that we shouldn't have supporters. I believe in the fact that let me just use Delaware as an example, and I don't want to go too far into Delaware. I'm not there anymore, and, you know, leadership has changed, and I don't feel like I can be Delaware anymore. But I can say that when I was there, which was 5 years, we started with a group of peers, and as we developed our program, we were extremely careful about this issue of self-disclosure and who people were and how they fit. And we had several interviews, not just one, but several, to talk about who they were. Another important aspect of those interviews were, you know, were they really far enough along in their recovery to do this job? And I think that's another fallacy along the way that and is even being, I think, even the legislation that we're objecting to right now. At one time, I had seen something about people that had received services in the last 2 years. I don't know where that went. I haven't seen it recently, but would be peer specialists. Well, people really should be further along, whatever that means. They have to define that, but they really have to be, they have to be pretty strong in order to take positions in, especially in inpatient, and that was kind of my specialty, but even in community centers. And two things happen if they're not, quote, well, I don't want to use the word stable, but if they're not feeling strong enough, and I will say this too, is that there's nobody so far along in their recovery that they're not going to have times that they need to take time off, that they need support.
You're saying that they should be so that they don't need to take time off. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm saying that there's nobody that you can define as being far along in their recovery that also isn't going to need support at times. Do you know what I'm saying? That also isn't going to.
Right. In other words, it should be built in that people will need to take time off.
Right. It's built. Yes, absolutely. Yes. But we were very careful about who we hired, about looking at, you know, all aspects. And were they even, you know, did they have transportation? Were they all kinds of things that made them good candidates? And the other thing that we did in Delaware that I think no state that I know of has done this, and people can maybe object to this. I fought for something that still is controversial, which is that we didn't take anybody for our training, which we developed our own curriculum, who already was not working as a peer specialist. And that may sound kind of strange, but we started hiring peer specialists in Delaware and carefully selecting them, and then they were given the training. And also they had to have been working a couple months. So it wasn't
so
like,
you didn't have people,
you know, and
that
I know
were,
that
you wouldn't have people, like I've seen this to happen, where you have people where you have 30 people trained as peer specialists, and then out of those 30, maybe 5 get a job.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, they come into the shop either working or knowing
that they have a job. We curtailed that whole problem, and it worked. It really worked because by the time they got to training, they had already been working for a while. There's also the time period of, you know, whether you yourself feel like you're a good fit for that job. Not everybody feels mm-hmm. that after they. It's hard. It is very hard work. And I think the hardest part of the work is not working with other people, but working in a system. And a lot of people think when they take these jobs that they're going to be fighting the system. You're not. You're not going to be fighting the system. You're going to be having to balance somehow or other. You have to figure it out, and everybody figures it out in a way, in their own way, of how they can be a strong peer supporter to another individual and feel good about it, but not have to say every other minute, you know, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong, and this is wrong.
Well, I think what, the people are saying that it's wrong. I think if somebody else just sent me, they sent me a message a while ago. These new peers only reinforce the system rules, goals, and missions to keep people in the system and not show them the way out. I think that what some people are saying, you know, is that we have many people that have strayed away from the original idea, and actually they just say, I've had people tell me, because they asked me to join the peer specialist group here, but I have not joined. They said, look, I'm just trying to get paid, or I just want these people to take the medication. And my role is to tell people what treatments they should and should not take. And for some people, maybe not in Delaware, but when you were there, but in some places it seems as though that some people feel as though that their job is to make sure that they're really not supporting their really a poorly paid mental health.
Right, they're a part of the system. They're supporting the system.
Part of the system. Because I remember Rita Cornice, like I said, I've had the benefit of you and other people. You know, people discussed how they could set line, but it seems as though that's not happening now. I was recently at a conference where someone got up, and in fact, they asked Mary Ellen Copeland. They thought they was two peer specialists. They had fallen in love, and they were told that they couldn't get married. So there's a wide range of how peer specialists are used or how peer workers are used, and I would love to say.
Well, here's what I think. And in terms of the medication issue, what I think the role of the peer specialist can be in terms of is first of all, the role of the peer specialist should – we avoided the whole or tried to, and I know that's changing. I know that and the worst thing that can happen to peer specialists now is for the legislation to insist or to somehow – put on a qualification that peers would be enforcers of the medication. That has not been the case of peer specialists. And again, there's all different places of what people are doing. But again,
well,
I'll just use Delaware as an example. In Delaware, we avoided that issue by not being part of being an enforcer. Our role, mm-hmm. as we saw it, was, or I think the best role to for a peer person, I'm using inpatient, and that's probably unfortunate because a lot of people aren't working in inpatient, but is to work towards the alternatives. So the goal in Delaware was to shorten the amount of time in the hospital and to develop alternatives in the community where people could go. So I think that one of the roles of peer supporters is to continue to work to develop our own peer support programs. And that may mean mm-hmm. that we need to find other funding sources other than government funding sources.
True.
That's one thing. I think people, I'm on the board of the INAPS, International
Association
of Peer Specialists. And we
mm-hmm.
just had our conference. And I can't remember the name of the presenter. He's a researcher who had done a survey I'm really, really poor on details, but several years ago there was a survey of where peers were at and what they were making salary-wise and, you know, how many states had peer specialist training programs and da-da-da-da-da-da-da, on and on and on. Well, what you saw was progress. You saw that the salaries had gone up. You saw that the roles had definitely increased. You see now that peers are working in the criminal justice system, which I think is a positive thing. And, I think the credibility of peers has to be within our own movement to elevate the credibility of ourselves, of being peers that can define who we are, what we can do. I'll use Delaware as an example again of one of the things that I think a lot of peers are not doing is that their peers had gained credibility even among psychiatrists, which is a big thing. And they were now being, and
wait
are
minute,
now,
you said,
being dependent
you said
on for, yeah, and you know, before I left, I talked to one of the psychiatrists who was at first very, you know, skittish about, you know, they don't know who, you know, what this role is, and they're the last people to come on board. Peers there had contributed, it began to show themselves really capable of being part of crisis intervention. So they were being called on, and, you know, to help, quote, de-escalate, you might not want to use that word, but to calm a person down, to intervene, to be one of the first places where, you know, a person in crisis would, you know, the whole role of prevention was prominent there. So I don't want to go back to Delaware again. That'll be the last time I'll mention it. But there are other places in the country also. I remember that Illinois, the peers there were contributing a great deal. And so you have different areas in the country where peers are, you know, and sometimes I've looked in on places where they have a big, you know, reputation. And I thought to myself when I looked closely at them, I thought, darn, they're not, you know, they're just not doing what I think is that important or that where I, you know, where I would want them to be. And then 2 years later, I would go back and then see that they had made progress. You know, so
I think you're pointing out that it's different. It's different in different systems, because
that's right.
In substance abuse and criminal justice and VA, they've always kind of used peers. But in the public mental health systems, I know that there are some people that are state employees, like Pennsylvania, probably has done a bad job in other places. But wouldn't you agree that most of the time, the wide majority of people who are in the mental health system may not really have access to a peer supporter?
You know, I honestly don't know that I could answer that, because when I'm looking around, Gainesville is an example. I'm now in Gainesville, and 5 years ago I left Gainesville. Long story short, my daughter had died, and I had, bought a house here and spent a couple of years in Gainesville. And at that time, there wasn't even a glimmer of peer support, nothing. And now I've been gone for 5 years. And what I've learned, I haven't even contacted these folks, but there's people in Gainesville, I know who they are. Frank Blankenship, I think, is one of them. He's part of the movement with David
Mind Oates. Freedom, Florida, yeah.
Mind Freedom, yes. It started a crisis respite program. And, you know, I have to look in on that. But, you know, and I know that peer support is now a common word. They're working in different, I haven't really been able to take a close look, but I've talked to several people that are, you know, it's come into being. It's come into play here. It's being a prominent part. Whereas, like I said, a few years ago, it just wasn't happening. I didn't even know a soul in Gainesville that was working on this issue.
Well, the Senate and the Congress have taken aim at those, and they want to, I don't know how much you know about it, but they want to nationalize this aspect of peer support.
Say that again, Yvonne. I'm sorry.
They want to, in the House and the Senate bill, you alluded to some of the Senate provisions, one being that you must be in active treatment for the last 2 years, but they want to codify the training that the peer specialists will have and what they have to do. Like, they can't talk against their provider. They can't talk against a clinical person. So they're not going to be involved in, like you said, any system advocacy at all. They're just going to be meeting the goals of the system. They have a
I keep wondering where it's at, and I keep getting emails, and it's kind of like, well, there's contra legislation, there's people working on it. I don't even know, you probably know better, you know, the players of people that are, you know.
Well, I understand the MHA is working on one, but I'm getting people to ask questions. The thing about it is there in most places, and I'm not asking you to talk about Delaware or whatever else, but because you're on finance, it's because there is no really career track. You know, for many people, it's just a dead-end position unless they have, you know, have higher education or they're a social worker or a nurse. I mean, you were a nurse. And I know that most of our peer specialists, where I am, most of them are contract workers. Some of them, if they happen to have a licensed social worker degree or they have other degrees, they'll hire them on at a case manager level. And, I know about the Pennsylvania and Arizona and some of the other places, but I just wonder, this is a very stressful job. As one of the people at PMMNS, it's a very stressful job, and people are getting paid low wages, and are we really setting people up to just be hurt if there's not proper supports for them? I'm talking about supports for the people who are even being peer supporters.
Well, there's just, you know, the truth is there are so many aspects to what makes these positions successful or not. One of them being, you know, are their supervisors peers? Does the administration support peer support? Do the peers have flexibility? Are they put in positions where they're just, you know, tokens? But here's what happened. If you look over the years, if you look, again, let's go back to history, is that our historians, which I like to include myself, set the tones for what was to happen later. What happened later, you know, somebody like Leonard Frank, who died recently, probably would shudder at all of the things you're saying and would say, I told you so. But other people would say, well, wait a minute, we're making progress. I'm probably one of the people, and I think Sally Zinman would say, we're making progress. Now, California, oddly enough, is one of the few states that didn't endorse peer specialists, and now they're doing it. They're, you know, but, you know, that in a movement, it's kind of like, it's not like the enemy is them. The enemy is us. I'm not even sure if this applies. I'm not sure if this is right. But the answer to the issue is ourselves. One of the things I thought about this legislation, I didn't take it on, but maybe somebody listening or, you know, is that, you know, the legislation is being sponsored by people that think they know what's right. They may not know what's right. They think they know because they know what they know. The same way with NAMI, and I don't want to get into that whole discussion. I hope nobody asks me questions because I don't want to get into what's wrong with groups of people.
I didn't
think there's
ask you.
An opportunity for learning.
Yes.
Yes.
There's opportunity for dialogue, but doesn't seem like they it seems as though they have an idea. I was up on the hill, and I've been within a few feet of one of the major supporters, Congress Mercia, is, and it seems as though, just like my friend Nancy Jensen says, that these people, they're only interested in two things: meds and beds. So
two things.
That seems to be their mantra.
Yeah, I remember Nancy Jensen. I think she's a nurse too, if I'm not mistaken. I think. I'm not sure. But anyway.
Yeah, she's listening to you now because she's asking a question about you. But she wrote a book recently.
But see, here's where I want to go with that, Yvonne. And
okay.
I've thought a lot about this. I just can't take it on. I think there should be a whole whole series of letters or petitions or experiences or testimonials, not long testimonials, but from the thousands of people that have benefited from whatever you want to call peer support, meaning the early survivors.
It's a benefit. Mm-hmm.
And that these letters would be sent to these congressmen, that there would be somebody who would take it on, which I'm not even sure if it's that huge
they've embraced peer support. That's not the issue. Is that? And I'll send you something later. They have embraced Tim Murphy. He says it's a good thing. But what they've done is they've delineated what they think you should be involved in doing and what you should not do. And they are really making the people be the what did they say? You said that the enemy
is
you.
Well, is there not a way that people could specify that their meds were helpful, but that was not their or people that had gotten off of meds? I mean, could not the varied experiences be expressed in all of these so-called letters or responses? You know, does the average consumer out there even know what's going on? See, I don't think the information is out there. I don't think, even at IMAPS,
the information's not out there, and what I'm telling you, Gail, is that they're specifying in the legislation.
I know.
And that's what's happening in many places. The people, you're mentoring system compliance. And compliance does not just mean medication. Compliance could be that you go to the day program or follow whatever their regimen is. And I understand what you're saying, that that's not the way it's supposed to be. But we have people that don't have any knowledge of the history that you and I have been talking about. They don't have any knowledge of that. And even so, there are many people that they don't have that kind of lived experience that we're talking about. They may have. I saw this about 8 years ago during the recession. You had people where they may have had some counseling or whatever else, and they were out of work, and they did this. We have lots of people, and it's different for people who've been in the mental health system than people who have had a substance abuse issue and they've come to it that way. But it is there are a lot of people who have been, I want to use the word, they have been co-opted. What they're doing is they're all those things that you put in the letter, maybe not quite up front, that you said the reason why you resigned is that they're being required to do. And I know that it's better.
Remember, let's go back to history, Yvonne. How did things change? Why is it that Berkeley stopped doing shock treatment? It was because people organized. what I'm saying is, you know, I know David Oakes and Mind Freedom have organized, you know, and continue to do that. But there's a broader perspective, I think, of many, many people who would endorse a petition that allowed them some flexibility in making choices, and that did not include, you know, I don't know, I wouldn't know how to frame the wording. I just know that
can't do that or they lost their job. We have people that can't talk to people because they will tell you, I can't be seen with you because, you know, you're on the hot list or whatever else. They're not doing that. You're in a position, and there are some people in the country, they're in a position where they can speak like that. And what happens is far too many people who can speak, they don't speak. So
we have enough people, I think, that could speak. I'm just trying to make a point that the problem out there is finally that we are the answer. We're the changers. We're the movers and shakers. We're the ones who, you know, can show change because we live change.
If we stay true to our values, if we stay true to our peer values, would you say if we stay true to that? And that's why I know every year that I've known every year, every other year, you and Sally get up and tell people a little bit of the history of the movement. And that's the reason why it has to be constantly reinforced, because there are many, many people, many more people, they just see it as a job. They're not in it because they don't have those same goals that we had 20 years ago or 30 years ago. And, you know, this is what they tell me. Yvonne, I'm just trying to get paid. You know, and
well, okay. Let me boil down them to three things, and then
okay,
maybe by that time we want to open it up because I'm real anxious to hear, you know, what other people are thinking about. You know, I like to think that I'm a listener at this point. You know, I told somebody that posted
these are little messages that I'm getting, and I'm sending the people telling me to come on, and they don't want to because this is what people are saying. But all the lines are open now. They're open. Anybody that wants to speak up, they can speak. But like I said, I told you this when I talked to you. I get people that send me the little messages. They don't necessarily want to speak themselves, like I said.
Oh, but do they give you the message that they want to convey?
You have a list of questions that they keep telling me you don't answer. But the thing about it is, this is, let's see. Wait a minute. This is something you probably don't know. It says, where are the client satisfaction surveys? And they will say, I cannot listen to the sales pitch phony stuff. These peers are not changers. They are collaborators. And what was the other one? Let's see here.
Yeah, talk slowly because I wasn't sure I heard all
these
that.
These are people are saying this. What good is it to work in a system that still harms people and are really nothing more than collaborators with the broken system? These are disenchanted people. And I already asked you because someone else had asked me about you. And they told me to ask you later. But, anybody that wants to come on, the lines are open now. You can come on and say whatever you want to say and let yourself be known. So I have all the lines open.
Yeah, there's anybody that wrote a message that you want to convey, or did you already do that?
I've been doing that as I'm talking to you.
I see.
In other words,
I'm
asking you. I've been doing this as I'm talking to you, and that's why you hear the little noise.
Okay.
You said, I said what I had to say. You did not get her answer. So I've been all during the time I do that,
okay.
Whether they do it through Facebook or Twitter or whatever else. And we have, like I said, people are upset about the change and what has happened. So,
I want to say that I do understand that.
And some people are saying, thank you for doing the show and having her. So I have been getting some people saying, thank you for you being there. I've been a couple of those. So, because everybody doesn't have long distance service. So.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that was that. But I want to thank you for coming on the show and to talking about those little tidbits for peer specialists. There are people where they don't think that it's, they think that the, how can I say it? They think that peers are not being true to, that are in the system are, they don't see them as being helpful. They see them as being the same thing. So there are some people like that, and there are other people that have worked, and that's what we're getting. And then there are other people who do see themselves doing good work, but they see the Murphy Bill as being a way of going back to being nothing more than a mental health, technician. So we have many people that are listening that have been, they have the similar experiences like you have, or they've worked in the system. Some people do not want to come on because they are working professionally or something other than that. But this is the first time I've ever heard where no one would say anything on the air.
And,
but
and
it
Yvonne,
might be because
it's a weekend.
It's a Labor Day weekend.
Oh, sure.
It's a Sunday. But
feel free to send me any messages by email.
Okay. And have you?
Yeah.
And I'll check, and I will post, for people that are listening, I will post on Tumblr and on my Facebook page the information about how to get on. You said Friday is your show? Is your webinar?
Right. And also, if you're going to send a message, would you mention about the book that I've written, You're Pretty When You Smile?
Yes.
And
okay.
they can purchase it on Amazon for $8.
That's good. I'm glad that you did that. And you're working on your memoirs now, right?
Yes, it's a poetic memoir. And I'll send me your address, and I will send you a copy, Yvonne. And I thank you for asking me to be on the show. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, and could you tell some, can you talk about Mad Arts a little bit before you go?
Oh, okay. I thought we were ending. I'm sorry. Well, I think the arts, you know, somebody wrote to you and said, is there anything that is free or is there any possibility of an organization that is without, you know, the system controlling it? And my answer to that is the arts. The arts cannot be controlled. What people write, what people draw, paint, express themselves is their own. It can be politically inspired. It can be personal. It can be from a variety of perspectives. And so I have felt, I've really felt lucky in a way over the years to feel like, okay, you know, I'm willing to fight these fights. I'm willing to, you know, fight seclusion and restraint. I'm willing to fight, you know, for how peers get treated. I'm willing to fight the battle of creating a good peer support program. I hope I've been able to do that. But the place I think that is easiest, that I have the less stress and the most enjoyment and the most, you know, sort of positive experiences with people is in the arts. And it's been, you know, when we first started the arts portion of, I call it an arts movement because, you know, artists had nowhere to go, no funding, nobody that gave them credit, no big place in the conferences. You know, when we did our talent shows in the beginning, the leaders met somewhere else, and, you know, just the poor people, I'll call them the poor people, but the people came to the talent shows. And it wasn't until much, much later that they began to be valued, you know, that the talent was being expressed, and that here was a place where people could really say, you know, and Howie the Harp was one of our early MCs, and then later Mark Davis, who doesn't chintz any words by any means. Do you know what I'm saying? People that were very radical have been, and now Sharon Wise has taken the place of the MC, who has her own position of leadership and outspokenness and all those things. And then myself, and, you know, I do this little expression of Henrietta. But it's a safe place. It's a safe place, and it's a place I want to continue to organize. Nobody else is competing for it because there's no money in it. But in fact, people are making money off their art, and we have several artists in the country who are putting out amazing stuff. I just had a message from, and I'll be doing my portion of the history on the arts, which is always well received. Sybil Noble is selling her work.
It is
for much, you know, Sybil and Megan Cawhey and Jerome Lawrence and Mike Skinner. Sharon Wise is selling her stuff for huge amounts of money now. I mean, it's like these were people that, you know, weren't being credited with, you know, nothing for their art. And so I'm like just so enthralled. I guess I just feel so honored, you know, to be able to
And you're going to have a pre-artist alternative again, right?
And I'll be there. So, I mean, an alternative has embraced the arts, you know, in a big way. Well, we could get into some politics of that, but anyway, I don't want to do it. Okay. So, you know.
Area code 802, are you trying to get in? 802? Area code 802.
Please, Yvonne, thanks so much, Sarah Knutson. Gail, thanks so much also for the, I mean, I love what you're saying about the arts and how critical sort of the interface between sort of arts and creativity and the creative spirit is for maybe our movement or what so many of us are trying to express. I also reading the description to the show, and I think that the idea of the national Mad Arts Festival. I mean, I'd love to see us do a Mad Stock, partly because for me, madness, it's like this. There's so much about madness, and it's mad. The idea of madness as a culture, and madness is standing for values that are that say, hey, there's so much more to life than living within the nominal box, and that so much of what gets us locked up is when we start to move outside the nominal box, and the people who seem, those of us, it seems to me like there's a group of us that respond quite well. There's a group of people who go into distress and they respond quite well to conventional mental health treatment, and those aren't those people, but there's a whole group of us who don't do very well with conventional mental health treatment. And distinction I would make, at least what makes sense in my own observation, more in my own experience, is that there's a group of people who see there's a vast percentage of human beings who really do care enough about social belonging and who are able somehow to say, okay, look, if I have to choose between my own individuality, my own creative expression, and belonging to the rest of the crowd, and, you know, having the material, the means to make a living and support myself and housing and all these practical things, that okay, I can shut myself off and I can shut that stuff down and do it as a hobby or something else. But you know, I can mostly choose to conform to the culture the way it is. And I think there's a whole there's another segment and a significant segment of the human race that, I mean, that's the culture that like can fit well and can kind of function within that the norm, what is the convention, it can respond to conventional mental health treatment, it can do okay. There's a whole group of us that are like, you know, it's like it doesn't matter if I mean I really do want to belong, I really do want to be housed, I really do want to have a job, but if I have to give up some part of my truth to do that, I just fail miserably. And so I can't respond to conventional mental health treatment because that isn't my nature to do that. So that, and I think that culture, and that's valuable.
Okay, let me respond.
Well, I agree with everything you said. Who is speaking?
My name is Sarah Knudsen. Thank you. I'm so sorry for not doing a good job of saying who I am.
No, please, and definitely contact me. Definitely. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you for everything you said. I agree with everything. Absolutely.
Thank you.
Very well said, too. Thank you.
Thank you.
And people, I just want to repeat again that I'm going to post on my Facebook page, which even if the person is my friend, they can see it. And on Tumblr, when I find out the call-in numbers for the history of the movement with Sally Zinman and Gail, which they said they're going to have on Friday. And I will remind people that you can listen in because people will be listening to the show. As I said, many more people listen after the show, a day or two after the show, than actually listen on the call. And you can go to Google Play and download the app for blog radio. And also there is a chat during the show. We have a chat open. So if you don't want to, if you want to ask a question but you don't want to come on, it is a live show that you can put those messages in there and I will ask the questions. I don't know, next Sunday I'm hoping to have Bruce Levine on.
Who are you having on?
I'm hoping that I have got a confirmation. Bruce Levine, he's a psychologist here.
Oh, okay.
You know who
okay.
he is? Okay. Do you know
no.
him? He writes some for Mad in America. Okay.
Oh, okay.
But,
all right.
Okay. Okay, and I want to thank you again for coming on and remind people that You're Pretty When You Smile, which is Gail's book, is on, you can find it from on Amazon. So if you go there, you can get You're Pretty When You Smile. And I want to thank you. I want to open up one last time if there's anybody else who wants to come on to say something there, because I think I've asked all the questions from the chat. Anybody else, please speak up now. Lines are open. Okay, Gail, well, thank you for coming on.
Okay.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye, thank you. Thank you, Yvonne. Bye.
You're welcome. Mm-hmm.